Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
I'm Nathan Egger from Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television encore presentation, we're bringing you another episode from Real Vision's Masterclass series. Famed investor Hugh Hendry likes to describe his investment strategy as essentially trend following, while the public and media have widely described him as a contrarian investor after his Eclectica fund returned over 31% in 2008, while most investors were busy losing their shirts. To describe Mr. Hendry as a polarizing figure would be a grotesque understatement, and I'm certain some of his views will conflict with many of your own. Just as Raoul Powell's views were challenged by those of Mr. Hendry in this Real Vision piece that originally aired on March 11th, 2016. It isn't often that Hugh Hendry grants an interview, so I consider this to be a real treat. We hope you all enjoy this week's Real Vision Television encore presentation.
Hugh, good to finally get you on Real Vision. You've been one of the most requested names out there. And people just want to hear what you say. And the best thing is you've got a different view to a lot of us, which is good. Because, you know, the whole point of doing this is to get a balance of opinions from smart thinkers. People who have a robust framework, I don't really care whether people are bullish or bearish, but it's just to hear how they think so other people can kind of formulate opinions.
Well, it's so good that we have this chance to engage at this point where you're looking a little bit smarter.
As you know from this business, when you think your shit smells of roses, you're about to get your face rubbed in it. I've been through this many times in the past.
You said it.
So, how are you, give me a framework. How are you thinking about the world right now? You're obviously familiar with how I'm thinking about it. How are you thinking about it?
I am familiar. And it would seem that my role in life is to annoy people a lot by not agreeing with them. My problem is I'm not stationary. I keep saying I live in the future. You know, I'm being kind of beamed back from 2018. And you know what? We're still alive, is my message from the future. And it ain't as bad as you lot seem to think or fear, is my presumption, is my bold presumption. So where do you, I mean, you know, this is like the Chinese civil service entrance examination. Tell me everything you know.
Yeah, okay, so okay, let's start somewhere simply. Let's start with the US economy. Where are you with the US economy? Do you think it's weakening? How weak does it get?
Yeah, so it's like wherever you choose to start, there is a very rational, logical fear and point of concern. Okay. In dog years, the US economic expansion is very old. Mm-hmm. And logically, as we know, these things, we don't have expansion, sadly, which persist in perpetuity. All good things come to an end. And so logical, and indeed, our brethren who manage or advise on speculating with proprietary capital, we like data, and we like cycles, and we like clues with where we are in cycles. And that clearly urges caution. It's an old expansion. So it's one of many. Wherever, if you will, the wheel would stop, we could alight upon a part of the global economy where the first response would be the articulation of a fear factor, and a very relevant fear factor. So let's just take that and then let's talk about me. because, of course, the key to this is what's going on behind the curtain, the Wizard of Oz. And maybe we'll come I've been reformulating my Frank Baum kind of analogies. They're still uncut, so I'm not sure, we'll see. But so clearly this is all about the guys behind the curtain. You know, are they all powerful, or was this all, you know, a confidence trick? I would like to approach it slightly differently because, and again, not to evade, but and so to take on head on, where am I with the world today? I am more tolerant of taking risk. I have opened myself up to more risk taking. And I've been in that manner since the end of 2013. And again, it created great rancor with the body politic, which were my investor base. They wanted me to be that just gloomy, curmudgeonly Scottish person that could only see Armageddon, right? And I had a franchise there, but it was a franchise which was boxing in my creativity.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, when the facts change, you have to assert your personal willingness to tread a different path. And business-wise, that's been tough, but...
But you can't play to the crowd.
You can't... you make a lot more money. But, you know...
Yeah, but there's no intellectual integrity to that.
I'm 47 in March of 2016. And, you know what? I've given up trying to please everybody. I am Hugh Hendry. If you get it, fantastic. We can have fun. And we will certainly have fun. And I certainly won't lose you any money. Or you're in the other camp and it's like, you know, I'm just not allowed, you know, I'm not allowed to be me, so fine. We part the ways. Anyway, so the central thrust of my argument and why I'm willing to open myself up to risk. So I had 2 years where I was curmudgeonly miserable for many reasons. Intellectually, however, I was miserable, which is a bit unforgiving. And I was miserable, kind of, I tentatively want to suggest, treading a path which I think you're very familiar with. I don't wish to put words in your mouth, but you know, I took that dim view of global central banking. And I tend to create a narrative which can persist for 2 or 3 years, which is a great luxury to give yourself that amount of time in this world of fast-moving prices. Partly I'm allowed that luxury of time because even when I'm wrong, I don't lose a lot of money, so I can kind of stick with it. I tend to be a surge fund. I kind of do nothing, and then I get the wave, and surge, I make a lot of money. And then I'm moving on. But I'm being called a genius, and people coming in, but I'm moving on to a new narrative. And I go, so I'm a stepladder, stepladder, stepladder. Yeah. I've got 14 years of demonstrating that behavior. So within that stepladder, I was too tough on the central banks. The thing worked. The mm-hmm. thing worked. Did it work perfectly? Who knows? But it worked. Because we came perilously close to a Great Depression Part 2. Mm-hmm. And we're not there. Here we are 7, 8 years in the future versus the catastrophe, which was 2008. And we're not there. And I believe we're not there owing to the courage of essentially bureaucrats and academics who are not remunerated anything closely like my brethren. They're not remunerated to take a gamble on their reputation and a reputation that will persist in perpetuity. You know, we can go back and we can lambast the Federal Reserve from the late 1920s. They made policy errors and real industrious people suffered for a generation owing to those mistakes. History doesn't look kindly upon them. So, crackheads, you know, you don't get paid anything for these decisions. You get ridiculed for these decisions because they're radical. And you could be put down in history forever as being wrong. So it's a brave person who does it. And fortunately, we have brave people at the Federal Reserve and indeed the Bank of England. And coinciding with some foolhardy behavior from our Chinese friends, but benevolent by and large in their super credit expansion of 2009. I mean, fantastically generous, fantastically silly, but the confluence of those two events mean that today in 2016, we are not dealing with a Great Depression Part 2, which was not a tail risk in 2008. It was not a tail risk. It was going to happen. Yeah. And it hasn't. And no one has stood up and congratulated them for those efforts.
But even if they did it right, let's say, I mean, I look back and think, you know, what other choices would they have made? I don't think there's many. Yeah. So they had to try. Yeah. And it seemed to have paid off reasonably. The question is does the marginal rate of return continue as it has been? Does it lessen? You know, has something changed?
It's paid off reasonably. I mean, you know, okay, you're going to start quoting like arcane labor statistics to tell me that we don't have full employment.
No, I'll just say the business. I'll just say we just had a normal business cycle that
we've
was slightly
had a long, steady business expansion, which has brought in people into the workforce. The quibble, and the great quibble, is still we don't have an answer for the skewed nature of returns. You know, this grotesque rich versus poor, the prevalence of of these Gini coefficients, etc. And again, I want to touch upon that later because I think there are remedies which are there, they're happening. I mean, I look upon capitalism as a lucky SOB. You know, just when you're willing to write it off, something turns up. Never bet against it. It's a lucky SOB.
But we have a business cycle that was relatively subdued compared to most others. So it kind of worked, but it didn't. It saved us, let's say.
Yeah.
So now the business cycle is now slowing down again. Does central bank policy help again? I mean, that's what I'm interested in, is looking forward into the future is the probability of success again.
Sure. Well, the biggest hurdle was that we had, again, a brave and by and large a successful strategy pursued by the US and the UK, largely in isolation, and again, with a bit of a crazy credit dash from the Chinese, okay? Yeah. The European economy, larger than the US, sat for 5 years with a catastrophically tight policy. Catastrophically. You know, with the dogma, the German dogma of the good deflation. There is nothing the good about the deflation, you know? So, you know, you've got, what are you talking about? $18 trillion in terms of an economic bloc, like dying. Being not allowed the correct money. They raised rates. Remember, they raised rates, you know, in 2011. Okay, so you have to countenance the fact that one big bloc didn't get it. Mm-hmm. You have to countenance the fact that the Japanese were trying, but they'd yet to really kind of get to the sizes which really make a difference. The exciting aspect was that at the start of last year, it looked like Team Global Central Banking was finally on the same page. Right? The US and the UK had the successful legacy. The good German deflation had been pretty much put to bed. The Japanese were just roaring with the intervention. And the Chinese were taking page after page from the textbook of especially the modern alchemy that the Europeans have practiced, how you know no one wants to buy Italian bonds at 8.5% yields, and you open the window and the bank says I'll pay you par for it, and I'll give you free money for the next 3 years. Bang, done. Okay, China's been doing that modestly with, you know, as we know, China has a credit and a bad debt issue, which is pretty much on a it's the same as the bad sovereign issue that Europe has been dealing with for the last 5-6 years. Why can't China have the same response, and why can't that be as successful as it's proven so far in Europe? So, as I say, 12 months or so ago, it was exciting, if you will, that we could really perhaps see the full force, because all we've seen is we've seen the force of radical modern central banking, but only in fits and starts and only in patches. And of course, the borders that the US kind of went Germanic. And you know, this system, the indebtedness of the world requires an incredibly generously low carry on the debt. The system does not work. Rates are capped.
So how did that work? So the US suddenly starts raising rates?
Spends a boring 18 months of talking about it and getting the market to price it in.
And that didn't set off any alarm bells to you to say, look, this might upset an apple cart?
From 0 to 25 and then
it gets reversed. From QE to tapering to no QE to 25.
What it meant was that there was clearly a monetizable investment opportunity, being long dollars and being long the equities in the other part of the world, which was, you know, moving the right way, maybe moving the manner which, you know, had the precedent of suggesting higher asset prices.
Yeah.
You know, the Jackson Hole meeting of August 2014 was just one of those amazing, very rare macro opportunities where you could actually put three concurrent risk books together, right? So we role play as global macro managers. If I was in their position, what are they thinking? What would I do, kind of thing? And you can kind of get there. You know, they're smart, we are smart. And it was pretty obvious that if I was a Fed governor, I'd be saying, it worked. You know, and you know, okay, a little bit of hubris, the George Bush on the, you know, landing on the aircraft carrier, but it worked. Here we are in the middle of 2014. We advocated easy policy from March 2009, and we've stolen everyone else's lunch. We haven't created wealth, but we have redistributed marginal GDP growth. So, you know, in 2009, China was growing at 10%, and the expectation was that would just persist, and the US was deemed to be over, okay? 5 years later, the US is deemed to be the strongest economy, and in perpetuity, China seems to have lost at least 5 points of, you know, annual GDP growth. So game over, it worked, okay? And so it's time, if you will, for the US to be benevolent once more. The US is a benevolent hegemon. It built Europe, it built Japan, or rebuilt Japan, it rebuilt China, owing to the orthodoxy that it pursues. QE was this experiment, because it wasn't shared by the other central banks, US QE was the Fed and the US Treasury being mean, and mean in that not willing to share and be generous with economic growth, that economic growth created in the US had to stay in the US. Okay, it was a fantastic success, relative success. So Jackson Hole, it worked. But you know what? When I look at the future, I'm not really that concerned. You know, again, this is the Federal Reserve guy talking to you, or the US Treasury spokesman talking to you from August 2014. As I look at the future, my existential angst is China. It either amuses me or I find it immensely irritating, you know, the European circus. And of course, what do we have to do to, you know, to repair our earnest brothers in Japan, right? So all of the risk is overseas. So at that point, it's time for the Fed to be benevolent once more and start talking about the need to raise rates.
So isn't the benevolence then of the US allowing the dollar to rise?
It did so. But as I say, as we were saying like 30 seconds ago, the benevolence, which is talking about, okay, we will run less loose policy and we'll start talking about higher rates, it has a cap. So the benevolence has a cap. You can only be benevolent so far. And you've done the charts of the DXY, the dollar index. Foreign exchange is looney tune land. Right? No one knows how it operates. You know, we can all come up with some hypothesis, right? But it's Looney Tunes market, and it works off trends and breaking trends. And you know, I'm as fascinated by that 30, 40 year downtrend and the break of it. And so clearly, you know, we were at 80 with Jackson Hole, we went at 100, we go to 110. And with the backup in interest rate expectations, the US economy, guess what? It slows down. And we lose the benevolence. We all have to suddenly get back on the team sheet, which is, you know, holy Mary, there's a lot of debt and there's a lot of problems, and actually we got to kind of stick together. But I'm kind of really losing the thrust of my argument. This is what we should be talking about, and it gets lost in the noise, which is risk parity. But it is the risk parity chart. It is the chart of U.S. equities versus treasuries on a vol adjusted basis. So every month, you're vol adjusting your treasury portfolio so that it has the same. And when I say you're risk adjusting, you're just buying more and more treasuries. So you're getting more and more leveraged such that those government securities have the same daily or monthly price volatility as the US. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you run that series from 1971 mm-hmm. to the present. How should that look? right? Because it has to capture, there has to be a vein of rationality seeping in from the real economy. There has to be something in the real economy which surely shapes and forms the nature of that relationship. It's not all about Ray Dalio running lots of money and being a god, okay? It's telling you something about the world. So if you didn't know what the shape of that curve looks like, over from 1971, right? That's 40 years, more than 40 years. How should it look?
But the problem is with it is there is one trend that we can't extrapolate out of that whole equation, which is the disinflationary trend since the mid-70s. And that's the tough thing to take out. Because I've looked at the risk parity thing, and it's intuitively interesting, but I can't strip out what that and the demographics does to
Absolutely.
That whole equation.
Okay, so first of all, equities on that basis have lost 75% of their value versus owning a lot of bonds since 1971.
Yep.
Okay. So we've got to put that out there. And then we've got to stop using the word risk parity. It's a blind cul-de-sac. It doesn't take us anywhere. Why have equities underperformed bonds by 75% since 1971? Okay, and why is no one asking that question? So you did raise an interesting point, which is that you hit the second part of it, clearly by the end of the 1970s. So following the inflation shock, which traumatized investors and policymakers. Okay,
it still does today.
And still, there is a legacy, a lingering, but it's really, it's the last burning embers of that thing. You know, these things die. They have half-lives which extend very far into the future. So you had an inflation shock. It ushered in a new regime of monetary management. Volcker was a revolution. 3 years after Volcker's appointment, you have, I believe, New Zealand actually explicitly having a target, a central banking target for inflation. And we know today that they just made up two. It was nothing scientific. Two sounded like the right number. Okay. And then, of course, the trauma of the inflation, because it caught people out, it meant that there was a risk premium embedded into forward-looking expectations. So rates were always higher forward because of what had happened backward, right? Okay. And hey, that takes 10 years to work its way out of the system, of the psyche. And just as that's happening, then we hit globalization and we hit the World Wide Web, for lack of a better generalization of technology, which as we know now, and this is all Johnny hindsight, okay? But all of these factors, I think, go a long way to explaining why equities have lost 75% of their value versus sovereign US Treasury bonds. And indeed, that's the same relationship. It's even more stark if you look at Bunds versus DAX or JGBs versus Nikkei. This has been a catastrophe for the risk asset, which we call equities, okay? And yet, we're sitting there and it's just triumph. We have built a new economic order. We have got the second largest economy in the world now is China. This is a system which has reached in and pulled up more than 1 billion people from profound poverty to something better. Yeah? This is an environment which created Microsoft, Apple, Google, right? This is a period of the longest and most sustained global trade, and yet equities lost 75% of their value, and no one's talking about that. That's just plain weird. Okay, so let me try and offer you my explanation. With hindsight, I think you can only conclude that interest rates were too high, given the circumstances or given what eventually played out.
Yeah.
And I would like to suggest that we can split the economy into essentially two halves, debtors and creditors. And the stock market represents the debtors, the entrepreneurs. They have a profound surplus of ideas, but they have no money in their pocket. You know, they have a deficit of financing. And let's call them the bankers or the creditors have a surplus of money and a deficit of what to do with it. And the genius of our market economy is it brings the two together and the system works. And it typically works very, very well. And what I want to suggest to you is that owing to that confluence of events, the inflation shock, the new monetary order with Volcker and inflation targeting, globalization and the internet, rates were too high. And essentially what happened, and it's not a critique, I'm not criticizing central banking, I'm just saying it's just that shit happens, okay? And what it meant was that effectively we over-transferred economic distribution from the debtors to the creditors. What you can say categorically is the last 40 years were a magnificent time to be a creditor. You were overcompensated. Creditors imposed a rent on us. Yeah? That's interesting, okay? And like I said, our system is a lucky SOB. And I think it is healing itself. And I want to suggest that the investment, a successful investment narrative for tomorrow is you want to be a debtor and not a creditor. And the system is changing it. So if you look at that price series in the US, that price series has stopped falling in terms of equities since the advent of quantitative easing, have matched the domestic treasury market on a vol-adjusted basis. I think that's significant. Okay, and I think they've done so, and again, keeping with my analogy, quantitative easing was very necessary to attack, to destroy this transfer levy from the debtors, the people who create wealth, to the creditors, the people who facilitate wealth. Okay, so by eliminating interest rate, nominal rates, you're halfway there. Now, clearly, you've got to deal with real rates, but quantitative easing certainly has taken us a lot closer in challenging, bringing down the nominal and the risk premium embedded in it. Okay, and I think we can see that trace element in how that chart is playing out. Secondly, you have had a significant pivot from our Chinese friends. They have, I got to say, they've been lucky or smart. You know, it's hard to separate, you know. When you look at Paul Tudor Jones and you look at his trade in October 1987, I want to say he was lucky. You know, because, you know, he's taken down the PBS thing where he's sitting there with that little chart where it looks like 1929 and it's like, well, we got to sell here. But I'm sure there was a lot more to that trade, of course. But he's a genius because he's kept doing it. Okay. Being a genius is staying lucky. The Chinese are close to that just now. They seem, I think, they're on a kind of lucky run. Time will tell. But the Chinese, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years, have pivoted away from a desire to be a creditor nation, okay? Their whole modus operandi was to be a creditor, right? I'm gonna accumulate savings. How do I accumulate savings? I don't accumulate savings because there is something deeply inherent within the characteristic of a Chinese person that just craves savings. This was done by a transfer levy. When you brought that peasant and you brought him into the metropolis and he had some job, and it may have been an awful job, but the productivity bound was profoundly enormous, and you paid him a pittance, but the pittance was 10 times more than he'd ever dreamed of making. And so he was happy, but he was getting no more than 10% of what the productivity generated from that transfer was. So that's why you had the savings. You know, if you read Michael Pettis, you're probably transferring in the order of between 5 and 7% of Chinese GDP from the private household sector and bringing it in to support the build-up of the infrastructure program. And you did it through not compensating the productivity. You did it through an undervalued exchange rate, and you did it through negative interest savings on the household sector. And that meant you were a profound saver. And that meant you were a creditor, right? And again, what I'm saying, remember, this is quite fascinating, because my thesis is you were overcompensated to lend money. Well, the noughties were the manifestation of that. You know, it was like, but I don't have a job. I don't want to know, but I've got a criminal conviction. I don't want to know. I'm going to divorce my wife. I don't want to know, right? Just take the money. That's what there was such a bounty, right? And China wanted part of that. Everyone wanted part of that. Our Arabian friends, with oil at $100 and more. Again, right, a sovereign nation, right? These are, I was gonna say leeches, that's desperately wrong term to use, but these were the faucets, if you will, that were distributing, you know, the incremental wealth away from the noble, debtor, industrious, entrepreneurial class to these hoarders. And the most exciting thing today is that it's changing in front of our eyes. Oil's at $30. That is hallelujah, hallelujah. You know, you're going from a coterie of, you know, people who are deemed to be intelligent because they're billionaires, and they're billionaires because they're sitting on this resource, okay? And they're the most catastrophic asset allocators of that money. Catastrophic. You know, they want to host Olympics and World Cups, and they want to own US Treasuries. That's their ambition. How can we push the ambitions of our children? How can we push that into the future and create prosperity with this hoarding and with no ideas, right? And the great thing is now it's over, right? As a Chinese citizen, you've almost got the productivity bounty. Your wages have more than doubled in the last 5 years. Your currency now, a BMW made in Frankfurt or wherever they make these blasted things, you know, it's cheaper. You can there's a quotient of the population that can buy these things. You know, they're in Japan. Japan's cheap for them. You know, you've given them wealth, right? That's powerful. And at the same time, oil at $30. Rather than having these mindless, poor, catastrophically poor asset allocators, you're putting $50 to $100 a week into the pocket of billions of people. I would trust billions of people.
So why is that not manifesting itself into consumer spending? It's becoming saving, which is interesting.
They are spending it. Are they spending it at the clip that, you know, like we're always impatient. We want to make money like yesterday, okay? If you look at consumer spending, it's fine, right? It's not catastrophic. It's nowhere near catastrophic. It's fine. It'd be nice if it was even more, but it's trending modestly, if you will. If you want to take it the other way, they're saving. Is that a bad thing? If you save more, you make the system more robust.
The system has to save.
So that. I don't really get a bad scenario out of that. I don't get a bad scenario out of it. So again, as I say, I'm in this world of more benign outcomes. And again, it came out of Asia. It came from China early on saying, game's up. Mercantilism sucks. It's over. Doesn't work anymore. We screwed every last US dollar out of that gig. Time for a change. And they were sitting there, as you know, they were sitting, and we've never seen its like in, how far back do we define economic history? Like the economic history that makes sense, you know, with civilization and banking systems and stuff like that. We've never seen an economy that only devoted 34% of GDP to household consumption. Just off the charts. I mean, I thought Philippines was low at 50. 50 was the benchmark for a very, very low figure, 34%. And so for all of the pretty scary, we started, you know, we rolled the wheel and we said, hey, let's talk about the US economy. And there's there's a genuine concern. The economic expansion is old, and we're due a recession. It's closer. We relied on China. Where do you begin with worry knots? Okay, the place is, you know, the list of worry knots is longer than my arm. I've got to use two arms. Yeah, but the savings grace is so you're coming from such an extreme of consumption to GDP that actually they have something which can create endogenous growth.
But how long is that time period between now and actually getting to a sustainable economy built upon consumption, which is where it's going to get to eventually?
And oh, that's 20, 30 years. Where I changed, you know, and I'm sure I'm not the only macro geek. I mean, how many times have you read Charles Kinderberger? Manias, Panics, whatever, yeah?
Love it.
How many times?
I grew up reading that.
I can quote it. I can quote page 100. Well, don't try me. It's been a while because I've rejected it now. I haven't rejected it. But what I've come to recognize is that there's a tiered structure to the global economy. And Charles is elegant and genius of a book is very appropriate for second tier countries. And by second tier countries, I mean those who lack a vigorous and large household consumer sector. So like endogenous economic growth, and they're very, very dependent either on capital flows or on trade flows. And they have no autonomy over monetary policy, okay? And then you've got the big boys. You've got the US, right? And it can do whatever. It doesn't give a damn about the currency, right? It's just not an issue, okay? Mm-hmm. And pretty much Europe's the same. Pretty much the UK is the same. Pretty much Japan's the same. I mean, look at Japan, yeah. China, I think, is the same category, that they can have autonomous monetary policy without being, and I know you're terrified about the currency.
Well, that's my point, is I agree, right? The second largest economy in the world. I just had a chat with Dan Tapiero before you came, and Dan's a good macro guy, and his view is, listen, it's ridiculous to have the second largest economy in the world with a peg currency to the largest. I think the last time that happens when the US and the UK split off, whenever that was, 1890s or something. That needs to go. And that corrects a huge macro imbalance in the world. And we can kind of get much closer to your scenario, finding some sort of balance where China can rebalance its own economy and everything works a bit better. But to have it's madness to have the second largest economy in the world pegged to the first.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's acres of common ground. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I've seen your very eloquent narrative on this. 100% agree. But I don't see it as being as contentious as perhaps you conclude, because the peg, and more importantly, the imposition of the peg following the catastrophe of 2008. So where we sat there for 2 years and the thing doesn't move. Okay. And then you re-peg on the dirty slide, and you've got something that has no volatility, and you get the opportunity to buy a profoundly undervalued currency. And at the same time, the US comes in with QE. Okay, and so you get no volatility, positive carry, just unarguable fundamental value. Okay,
best carry trade in the world.
It's the best carry trade in the world. Okay, now it has nothing to do, right, with people like me. It's got nothing to do with hedge funds. This is all about large Chinese corporations, okay? An S&P 500 company, a FTSE 100 company, overseas revenues hedged into the reporting currency. In China, not a jot. Why would you, right? The central bank is throwing confetti at you. Like, take this free money. But profound wealth transfer from the PBOC to anyone that wanted it. Anyone was big enough to get it, right, had it. I hear that. And it's a monstrously large figure, okay? But the PBOC drew a line in the sand at the beginning of 2014 and said, this has got to change. This will change. And if you remember, that's when you had these structured products and they threw vol at it. They allowed, you know, they changed the fix and we were up here and people were, shit, what just happened?
It's not free money.
What just happened? Now, again, I'd like to talk about myself because that opened up one of the best ever global micro trades, which we've had the good fortune to participate in. And I don't hear anyone talking about it apart from us. And we're in the dying days of the trade. And it's a fixed income trade in the CNH. You're essentially paying, or you're long the forward point. So you're using foreign exchange to create the artifice of a fixed income paying position. So to your point, such was the monstrous size of the carry, okay, that you had this profound pool of money, but the wrong side of the wall, the wrong side of the capital wall. And here you've got this economy that has a profound need for credit and is like, it's just there. But my arms are too short. And so you could, the manifestation of that was that CNH, for the same duration, for short duration, for 6 months, the offshore rates were 1% and the onshore were 5%. And it should be pari passu, but it's telling you the presence of all this liquidity which is trapped. And yes, we saw the very determined attempts via over invoicing and the collateralization of commodities to bring some of that money, but it's a drop in the ocean. And so there was very much a bullish, you could have your cake and eat it both ways. Again, and I just said that word bullish, I'm banned. Kick me if I say bullish, bearish, okay? It does not do justice to the nuances involved in what we're attempting to do in managing a global macro portfolio. And I find myself using it in a lazy manner sometimes in presentations. I've got to stop doing it. But in terms of a benign, benevolent outcome, another B word, there you had to bet that they would have they would follow through on their promise for further liberalisation. And again, the carrot of the IMF approval for the currency, etc., was there, and they needed to liberalise further. And the not just the IMF, but in actually getting that credit on site into a slowing economy, you're going to make it happen. Okay, and if it happens, you're going to get convergence. So it's going to be like, you know, it's the 1990s fixed income convergence trade. Yeah. And that's your bullish case. And then you've got your bearish case where, you know, you take your carry trade, it's monstrous and it gets out of control. Or, you know, the economy just really, truly hits a wall and they can't fabricate numbers and they've got to produce zero growth or whatever. Yeah. And money's just fleeing the place. Paying rates overnight is a fantastic bear position, right? You're going to make a fortune. So, you know, in this benign, benevolent situation, you're going to make money and you're probably going to make decent money. And if the shit hits the fan, you're well, well covered. I mean, that's, you want trades with a huge landing strip. Yeah. And 2014, it delivered from the liberalization. And you went, the onshore rates came down to 3 and the offshore rates came up to 3. Fantastic trade. And then we ran that early last year. And then, you know, trades expire. And we got convergence, conspire. Then you got the kind of cack-handed nature of the intervention in August, which was further angst and further determination by the policymakers in recognizing your caution. I mean, I think they hear you. They're unhappy with that carry trade. They're unhappy with doling out this free money because there's nothing in return. Now, remember, I absolutely adore Mark Hart. I mean, I adore him at a human level. I mean, he is, you know, I'm not here to kiss ass, but he is, I mean, he's a Texan as well, isn't he? I mean,
and he's such a lovely bloke.
Something about Texans, they're just beguilingly nice. And he's been there and he's done it and all the rest, but, you know. But I think they hear it. They hear the message. Implementation last year was cack-handed.
But Mark's view would be, and I share this view, is it's good for China if the central bank is holding all these reserves in dollars. The best thing for them to do is just devalue, use the dollars, paper up the holes in the banking system, and everyone can finally move on.
I mean, nonsense.
You think the slow death is the better way?
I just think it's catastrophically wrong thing to say. First of all, PBOC is not a hedge fund, right? It is not there, right, to be marked to market. It's not there to make, you know, 20% performance fee on making 10% on the year, okay? It's there to be willing to lose money for the greater good of its society. And what Mark and your lot have yet, I think, to fully demonstrate is what a devaluation, what positive benefits arrive from a devaluation of the renminbi. And you seem to be forgetting also that the biggest importer of commodities in the world is China. Okay, the terms of trade in China have soared. The currency movement, the strength, barring the last 5-6%, you know, either policy prescribed or market force generated weakness. But, you know, in the course of the last 3 years, it's a stronger currency, strong against everything bar the US dollar, is determined by the terms of trade. The terms of trade are off the charts. Okay, you've had Japan, the world's third or fourth largest economy, have a 50% devaluation. Cannot see it in the global export share of Chinese companies. Cannot see it. Okay. And I said to you that in rejecting the mercantilist model, the problem of mercantilism was that it subdued, it denied you endogenous growth because it impoverished your households. And for the last 3 or 4 years, very consciously, every step has been to enrich the Chinese household. And you enrich them through a stronger currency, right? And we might finally get there, but their economy is growing at some fictitiously high figure, but it is growing. I think everyone agrees it's growing faster than the US economy, it's growing faster than Europe, it's growing faster in Japan, and there is not widespread unemployment.
But isn't the mercantilist part of this whole equation is you're dead right. If you look at Chinese share of world trade, it has not fallen because of Japan. but Chinese share of global profits probably has. I've never looked at the number, but my guess
it was never on the metric.
But that's
or on the radar, you know.
So that's mercantilism. So
that was mercantilism.
They've not walked away from mercantilism. They've kept market share. It's like OPEC now. Keep market share. We'll keep our people happy.
You see, the terms of trade have allowed them to keep market share.
I don't know.
I made that statement up. You know, that's what I do. It's called conjecture.
Yeah,
but the terms of trade, you know, the biggest beneficiary on the planet for the end of the super cycle in commodities, without a doubt, is China. It would be an incredible buy if actually they had a system, a more widespread system for wealth creation via organizing profitable enterprises.
I would argue it's probably actually India, because India's still got the infrastructure to build. China's at least built a lot of it. So they've...
Yeah.
Yeah, India, I think...
Well, yeah, but, you know, infrastructure works with... India is relevantly interesting, but, you know, I've yet to see the invention which takes out the Indian bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't know.
And hey, I'm long the currency, but like me and a million other macro guys, you know. I mean, I would be long the renminbi, the Chinese renminbi today, for that terms of trade argument. There is just an unquantifiable political. I cannot rule out that they go rogue. And that they get convinced by your arguments, and we wake up one day and they've gone bonkers. But they truly, if you wake up,
but it is a great, would be a great. I mean, if you think of geopolitics, and this is stuff, look, neither of us know anything about, right? I hate geopolitics, and I've paid for geopolitical research and found it the most useless thing on earth. And what I've found is that just thinking this through is, if you were China, and you thought you had a potential chance of the prize, the overall prize, which is being the most important trading nation in the world, then to screw the US with allowing them to have a massively strong currency alone is a pretty enticing strategy.
No, it's not. It is a catastrophic strategy for many reasons. The US and the rest of the world, I think, so let's say dollar-yen, let's jump countries.
Okay.
So everyone's short the yen, and we broke that 115 level, and we came rapidly to close on 110. And it goes to 100. And the Japanese come in with a monster of intervention, and they push it back to 120. Is the US going to be up in arms? Yep. Europe going to be up in arms complaining about it? Yep. No way. Tomorrow we wake up, and I mean, I would jump out the hotel window if this was the scenario, but we wake up and China has devalued 20%. The world is over. The world is over.
So I'd take the opposite side. I would say that was the best thing to happen.
The world is over. Euro breaks up. There's no euro in that scenario. The US economy, I mean, everything hits a wall. Everything hits a wall. You know, on your dollar, the dollar strength that you imagine is the devastation, because you've just eliminated dollars, right? They're a scarce commodity. You've wiped it out. And China is a pariah state, right? So it's a Mad Max movie, right? Okay, China gets to be the king in Mad Max world. How appealing is that? Right. There is no world after the tomorrow where China devalues by 20%. There is no world. Yeah, it's Looney Tunes to believe that people say, oh, well, you know, they needed to catch a break. Their share of world trade is like never been higher. They're facing no pressure, immense terms of trade improvement,
global manufacturing. But world trade itself has fallen so dramatically. So world trade year on year, in dollar terms, sure. Is the second lowest since 1958. It's ridiculous. It's fallen.
The growth rate has gone to 2 or something. We were running at 7.
Yeah,
seven,
and that's problematic when you're running such huge debt denominated in dollars.
There's no world trade, right? We're talking about world trade expanding by 2% year over year. I'm talking about, in that scenario, world trade is down 25%. You will probably have passport restrictions. I'm talking about military, and it's the world is over in that environment. It's over.
Yeah, and
I've got to trade for that environment, because I can't say never. happens, because no, you know, again, we're talking about
probabilities.
There's an illogical kind of, you know, policy-making angle to these things. And the one that I might annoy people, but I endure. That's my 14 years. I'm certainly not the largest global macro team in London, but I'm amongst now the longest running. I've survived just about everybody. And I continue.
Yeah, who's been around longer in London? Crispin?
Crispin. I mean, I used to. You know, I'm a Crispin baby.
Yeah, know. That's right.
I'm the love child of Crispin Odie. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, there's not many. There's a few of the US guys who have been around there longer. Yeah.
I guess I started the same time as Brevin. And they've certainly raised more money.
Yeah, just a bit tad. So moving back, so you've got a more benign view. You understand that there's risks either way. You think the balance of probabilities lies in the benign option. So how does that fall out into actionable opportunities? So where does
absolutely.
That...
Absolutely. No, great question. So we mentioned India, and India certainly has an allure because it has so much potential if they could just be modestly sensible. And eventually they'll get that. And you were in the early stages of, you know, it's a fine romance. So you want, and we have, I think, almost certainly the end of a super cycle in commodities. Mm-hmm. And therefore the ramifications will persist. Like this isn't a 1 week trade. The shadow will be cast for years and years and years. So you want to be long, you want to have an FX trade. You want to be long those nations, which are, they have a, like I said, that tier one versus tier two. So those nations which have an enormous indigenous household consumer market, which is many times larger than their exposure to overseas trade, okay, and where they are principally an importer of commodities. Okay, so India yells at you.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's boring because everyone's long that trade, and we've had a lot of balance sheet reduction, and it suffers. So you don't see that trade come through. So let me describe the long aspect, and then there's a short aspect. So what else fits the bill? And we want to keep it within a tight geographical corridor. So let's stick to Asia. Mm-hmm. Philippines, okay, doesn't export commodities.
Yeah.
And for the last 10 years, they've got marginally smarter on their political economy. There's an election cycle about to kick in, and maybe they go rogue. So we have to
watch
that
with close. Filipino politics.
We have to watch it. Yeah. But their politics the last 10 years have been remarkably good. And then you've got to... You need to get a little bit edgy and take a little bit. And so I would include Indonesia. And you're going to say, but they export in, but they export commodities. Yes, they do. It's about 12% of GDP. But they also import commodities. And that 250 million people in the household sector, you know, it's the same story. It's untapped. There's potential. Maybe, you know, maybe we get more of a pivot with you. It always sounds like a Star Wars character, Yodo, whatever he's called. I'm being ungracious, but you know, their newly elected president. So actually, because that's edgy, and people haven't been willing to be long there, it's been a great trade year today. Yeah. So you put those three together, okay?
Iran's the other one I like out of that mix.
I know.
P of 5.
Fantastic. Okay, I can put 10 grand.
No, it's a $10 billion stock market.
Yeah.
It's good enough for me.
How much can you put into... How?
Yeah,
how,
you can't I, put... You can't put a ton, but it's...
Yeah, you can't put enough that makes a difference.
But it's not like we're Brett Allen Howard, you know?
No, but
we're,
even,
we're not
I mean,
Bill
even
Gates
me,
trying to throw around some of our cash.
Even for the, you know, the circus machine that I am, you know, and the... I mean, thankfully, my size meant that I could trade that Chinese fixed income trade. I mean, yeah. You know, if you manage billions, I mean, we're talking lots of zeros when you trade this thing. Iran. But I, again, I'm trying to keep within the Asian corridor, and I'm trying to put $20 or $30 million into each of these currencies at least, you know, and arguably more. So I've picked three longs, if you will, three benefactors of the end of the super cycle in commodities. And what am I short? I want to be short. Those who are just so vulnerable to the catastrophe, which is the incremental growth in world trade, because that is their economy. So Singapore, Taiwan. And it's so catastrophic because that's all they do. They do not have a burgeoning consumer economy which can take up the reins. It's just too small. Statistically, it's just too small. And Korea, it's the same. You know, they've got a, you know, they have a mature consumer side which is leveraged. It can't do enough to offset the weakness, on the other hand. And probably Thailand, I would have Thailand there. It's too open to world trade. It's too vulnerable. So you kind of configure and you bring those two together and you start to get a kind of long debtor, short creditor type trade.
What's bizarre is, so here we start two entirely different views and yet we have the same trades.
No, because there's a lot of... there's a lot of great trades out there. I mean,
because they come from different angles, but they stack up from a number of ways, which makes the better trades.
Well, indeed. And actually, that brings me back to point. Because, so again, let's go back to the really, you know, let's be Austrian economists and paint dreadful Armageddon scenarios and blame the central banks. And you know I like speaking in metaphor. So I was very reluctant. I underwrite risk, and I was very reluctant to open myself up to risk. And indeed, I feared the consequences of other people's behavior during the noughties. You know? And if you will, it was like the Federal Reserve under the tutelage of Greenspan had effectively created an airbag. And we saw I was thinking about this the other day when I was watching Mission Impossible, the last one, whatever, with the final scene where he has to get to the bottom of the car park and he's busted his leg. And so he goes into, you know, a car and they push the car open and it drops five stories and it's fine because he's saved by the airbag. Yeah. So monetary policy and its impact on how people interface with risk assets was, I've got to pick the kids up. There's ice on the road. I'm late. Who cares? I'm going to drive fast, right? Because the consequences are just, they don't scare me. And I think the untold genius of quantitative easing is that you've replaced the airbag with the dagger that we're all driving with, this very sharp object, like an inch away from our chest. And that sharp object is, well, these central bankers are crazy. That sharp object is, well, the US economy is due a recession. That sharp object is, when will Japan ever grow? The existential angst of China, will we have a euro? Will we have Brexit? I mean, is Scotland going to be an independent nation? I mean, you name it. It's like, shit, right? So everyone's driving, like, and the kids would just have to wait. I'm really going to drive this thing slowly and cautiously. So for me, again, I kind of want to underwrite risk. The people I'm underwriting are being a lot more.
So what does that mean? What does that? So when it comes down to underwriting risk,
so it means
risk,
if you can take away these geopolitical and these highfalutin macro existential angst, there's a lot of opportunities to make money. Right, so let's go into Europe. In a fixed exchange rate where the constituent members are denied the opportunity to readjust via the external value of their currency, mm-hmm. Logic would dictate that capital flows within the system will be shaped and formed by relative domestic prices. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Germany, Spain, German property. Okay, Berlin property is still cheaper than Madrid. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know the end game for the redistribution of capital within Europe is where German properties just so immensely overvalued versus Spanish that German risk takers want to do that capital allocation.
And that trade works very well in the event of, let's say, you're wrong and Europe breaks up. So where's the money going to go? It's going to suck into German property because that's the safe.
And there's been a bit of that. So the UK property market is, you've had EM, I was going to call them tourists, but EM hoarders, again, creditor. Orders. Yeah. And clearly that's at risk, and we can see that leaning over. They're not in Berlin. Now, you know, there are warts in every good story. They've got the lunacy of rent controls. But the rent controls were very much the Schroeder mercantilism plan of 15 or 17 years ago, where, you know, we're going to export it a great deal. We're not really going to give you your fair share of the productivity. But when you go home, you're going to live in a really nice square box and it's going to be really, really cheap. And it's going to stay cheap. And that was there was a lot of kind of quid pro quo. That was a quid pro quo. The problem, even before you hit the million immigrants, is, you know, that environment did not encourage new build. And so they now, so you want to trade with a catalyst as well, like an immediate catalyst.
Yeah.
They just have to change. So, and the German surveyors are the very, very conservative. And they're, you know, they're valuing these things off 6% yields.
When so German bonds that? Are 18, the German REITs or?
No, they're quoted, yeah.
Just the quoted German.
Yeah. And, you know, I just bought Japanese REITs this week. My problem, God, you think you're clever and then you realize how dumb you are. I've been sitting for 3 years with Abenomics looking at Mitsubishi Real Estate and going, it keeps going down. I don't get it. You know, the big Japanese real estate companies, they just always plow the money back. Tokyo just gets bigger and bigger, or the buildings get taller and taller, and the shareholders get nothing. They get nothing. Yeah. Whereas the Japanese REIT sector, my God, it's like a different planet in terms of, you know, we aren't, yeah, you're like me in the sense that we look at, there's a degree to which we need the intelligence of others as manifest by market prices and trends. Here we are in paneled rooms kind of making things up. Remember, I always... I'm banned from saying it, but I don't care. I'm a schizophrenic. I hear voices in my head. You hear voices in your head,
absolutely.
Right? Because you're interfacing with the world, and your subconscious is processing during the night, and you're coming up with these kind of conclusions.
Because you have to balance two sets of probabilities in your head to trade global macro. There's no other way of doing it.
Yeah. And so you have those voices, and they lead you to take investment decisions. And then my life is full of foreboding. I spend half of my day worrying about what I've just done.
Yeah,
cool. More than half of my day.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, so we've got the German property side, which again, another trade I agree with, thinks a great trade. It's been going for a while, but it still goes. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
You can RV it against.
And don't forget, with a pension system with the funding problems that it has, 6% yields in German property is a stunner.
And with the pullback in equities, you're trading at good value.
So in what situation does that trade not work? I don't see it until yields drop to extraordinary low levels.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't. It's
illiquidity.
It's a bit like your Iranian trade. You know, I can do it because my AUM is modest.
Well, others have bought property. I mean, there's a ton of people who've gone and physically bought property.
But you know, my business is listed market prices. You know, where I reserve the right to change my mind later today, and I can change my portfolio. That's necessary.
And so if we look at the US, what do you see interesting? I mean, I just think, I don't know, well, we'll see whether we get common ground there, but...
US, the Eurodollar market is... the Eurodollar market is being confronted with Jekyll and Hyde type behavior by market participants. It would seem every 3 months markets are 100% certain that rates are going up, or 100% certain that we're going to have negative interest rates. And the nature of the Eurodollar market and the options on it, you get cycles within that where you're just paid to take trades. You know, and, you know, we started somewhere this year, we were being paid really to take the trade that they have two hikes. Is that my central thesis? I have no idea what they're going to do.
The tail in both sides of that. So I've got the other tail on, which is negative rates. Yeah. And I've had it on for a while. Paid one tick for the 1975 calls in December 2016 and the 2017s. So your loss is nothing.
Yeah.
And your upside is massive. And the other side is equally, right now, because there's nothing really priced in either way.
Your loss is nothing. Bear in mind that the route to nothing can sometimes be a bit arduous with some of these trades.
Yeah, and I've lost a ton of money in those trades in the past.
That's very modest. US... I was sounding like the man in my the man in the box. Every now and again, my Apple PC goes, U.S. unemployment is 220,000. I go, like, where did that come from? You know, the U.S. The U.S. is hard for me to have trades just now.
Listening to what you were saying about the shift away to the creditors, i.e. entrepreneurs, is something that John Burbank talks about. You know, his thesis is we've got some problems to get through. The other side of that is what's happening in the US is a real huge shift, which is the ability for people to now create new businesses again, not so much invest in old businesses, but physically go and build stuff and find capital to fund it, which
is a great thing. And that's the great thing about John's thing is that deep, deep down.
He's an optimist.
Below that elephant skin, he is. He's long optimism, you know, which is smart. Now, allied to that, and I think it's, forgive me if you've done it, but I don't think you've done it, but I think it's definitely something you should pursue, is getting, there are some really good people who can come on and really rant about GDP accounting just does not capture what's going on in the real world.
Yeah.
It doesn't capture it at all. Like, you know, Wikipedia is free, right? But it has no GDP significance, really. You know, we've had a revolution in leisure. Well, leisure really is not measured in GDP.
I'm not smart enough to figure that out. Who is? I understand GDP is a shit method of taking
people are still, I'm doing a presentation tomorrow, you know, and the guy before me is using Tobin's Q. It's like, it's really high. What's, I mean, in a market, in the world that we live in today where you have Facebook, how much capital does Facebook need to hit 1.2 billion people? How can Tobin's Q be still carried out and presented as another dagger on your steering wheel? You know, the world is changing dramatically.
So here's a thought, maybe another area for common ground. So let's say you take a relative bet of a market versus another. Sounds like you're more likely to be long the US and short an emerging market or even Europe.
Don't want to commit myself to that statement.
Right.
In general terms, yes, but in terms of that, that's a kind of 10, 15 year statement sort of thing.
Well,
but
normally,
because it's your starting point. I've been buying this week. I'm going to regret saying this.
Well, it won't, because it'll be in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Well, I did, but then that's what I've been written. But, oh, you idiot, really? You did that? You know, I'm talking about R&D. You know, we always have, you have R&D positions where you're touching things and saying, I wonder if I can hold this. But I got curious again with China coming back from the New Year holiday, and we put some money into Chinese equities. We had a basket of 8. We bought them like a genius. We bought them at the end of the fourth quarter 2014, and like complete amateurs, we held on and round trip back to zero. It was just awful. 14 fantastic, 15 exit point catastrophic, catastrophically dumb. But we were doing futures, and we got blindsided by that whole premium discount thing on the Hang Seng enterprises,
yeah,
versus the kind of equivalent onshore stocks, and so we were denying it. There was insanity, but we're saying, but look at the discount. Actually, we don't own the insanity, but guess what? You own the insanity, yeah. And within that, of course, if you buy the futures, you're owning banks. Again, banks were the conduit for the creditors. It's no surprise that banks are blowing up. Okay, 5 years ago, banks were the biggest private sector employees in every country. Now they're laying people off. You know, my debt, my bond versus equity thing is changing. The world is changing. Banks are not the place to be.
No.
And that's a positive thing again. Yeah. That's a positive thing. So,
because financiers are going, entrepreneurs are on the rise. That's a great thing.
Yeah. But yes, the US is definitely a place for it, but China is so loathed, and people are just so not there that you go in and you buy large cap names, diversified basket of 18 names. They're not banks, they're not state owned enterprises. They've all been trashed of late. So I'm kind of touching it. I'm curious. My question is, will I be able to hold this? I can't own much because the vol is up here, so my position down here. But there's something. Brazil. I've actually been buying Brazilian banks again, a speck of Brazilian banks. I'm curious. Maybe banks work in a high nominal interest rate. Brazil isn't another planet. I mean, this is in a universe far, far away, in a galaxy far, far away. You find Brazil, where those. So I'm kind of trying to receive the rates. I think there's so much to hate about Brazil's officialdom that actually when the hating gets so great that you kind of have to again be a little bit benevolent. So I'm trying to touch modestly, receiving a modest long in the real. I mean, people will be watching this in 3 weeks' time going, "Oh God, what a moron!" and then I'm thinking, actually, banks work in a world where you start cutting from 15. They don't work when you cut from zero to negative. You know, and you know, the Brazil is a fantastically different banking system where they have got incredibly profitable, legitimate private sector banks, and with the state having to retrench from its very the malpractices of the state-sponsored lending again to their SOEs, it's leaving a bigger patch of ground. You get to buy them on about one times book. You know, intriguing. So, you know, thought bubbles, which are emanating from the fact that I think the dollar move, the dollar is capped in the same manner that interest rates are capped, and therefore we may be that the storm, the intensity of the storm may be shifting with regard to EM, and maybe I've got to put some trace elements into my portfolio to see if I can own them
to test the water and see how it works. I think we're going to run out of time because we've been talking for an hour. But Hugh, fantastic. We'll have to do this again. We've got a lot more to talk about, but there's tons we missed.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.